Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 58. The secret to writing a screenplay is keeping your ass in the chair. Oliver Stone.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. The show is also sponsored by my new book, Rise of the Filmtrepreneur: How to Turn Your Independent Film into a Money-Making Business. In it, I discuss how to actually create the filmtrepreneur model and how to make money with your film or films and do it again and again so you can actually build a successful career and business. Head over to filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Now, before we get started, guys, I want to thank you all for the amazing response I've gotten with my new book, Rise of the Filmtrepreneur. It jumped to number one on Amazon within 24 hours of its release. So I am humbled and thank you so, so much. The reviews have been coming in, the messages have been coming in, and I am so glad it's resonating with the tribe. And I know that this show is about screenwriting, but I think that the future is for screenwriters as well as it is for filmmakers is to become a filmtrepreneur, to become an entrepreneurial filmmaker or an entrepreneurial screenwriter. And I'm going to be talking in weeks and months to come. I'm going to be creating specific training and specific things for screenwriters and how they can create their side hustles, how they can create revenue streams off of their writing to help them get to where they want to be and build businesses around your craft as well. Now, today on the show, we have script doctor, ghostwriter, and consultant Peter Douglas Russell. He is one of the most sought-after script doctors in Hollywood and has worked with many big companies and studios working as a script doctor. And that is one of the reasons why I wanted to have Peter on the show, because I wanted to kind of do a deep dive in what a script doctor does and confessions of what a Hollywood script doctor does specifically. He's got stories and stories and stories about what he does, how he does it. And we also go over his process, his storytelling process called The Story Maker. And I really think you guys are going to get a big kick out of this episode because it is plumb full of knowledge bombs without question. So let's get to it. Without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Peter Douglas Russell. I'd like to welcome to the show Peter Russell, man. Thank you so much for being on the show, my friend.
Thank you, Alex. Big fan. I think that you've got the whole Joe Rogan thing going. I really think I see great things ahead.
I appreciate it, sir. I appreciate it. Now, how did you get started in the business?
Well, I was a theater director in New York, in New York City, and I was doing really well. And then I went to a Broadway show and I saw what the directors were making, even though they were on Broadway, but they didn't have hits. And I realized I was going to be poor my whole life. And I was getting married and my wife wanted to move to L.A. She's from L.A. I said, well, let's go out to L.A. because I don't think theater is going to ever make I'm never going to be able to buy a house.
So then you said screenwriting. That's where the money is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The get rich quick scheme.
It's screenwriting.
Get rich in 30 years.
Exactly.
Scheme. Yeah, exactly. Or get rich never and live off Social Security. Yeah, but yes, you're right. But of course, and then I'm an idiot like every other idiot. Uh-huh. And decided to go out here. And then I lied my way into a job for CBS working for Sunta Itsekupo, who is a brilliant, brilliant producer of what back in the 90s was what was saving CBS, which were the movies of the week that they had, mm-hmm. which was the thing then. Mm-hmm. And CBS was completely in the toilet. And this and Sunta was – she's an amazing genius of a producer. We made 80 movies a year, close to it. At CBS, and which is more than all the studios made. Granted, they were $3 million movies, and
still,
they took 6 weeks. But I learned from her what commercial story was and how powerful commercial cinematic story is. And of course, it was a genre. It was called the men are no damn good. That's what we called our stories. Men are no damn good movies.
So Lifetime, basically. So Lifetime.
Yeah. It was, in fact, Lifetime took away the business eventually. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the execs hopped from CBS to Lifetime. But by then, Les Moonves was there, and CBS is really coming back. But I learned just how to quickly. I was a script reader, and I learned how to quickly assess story, and I learned a lot about what makes great film story, because movies were everything then. And I started doing these notes. And then these notes, I did script coverage, and then people would read it, and then the people that were making the movie would read it, the director, and they'd say, hey, you know, this is really good. These notes are great. So what we got this problem, you said, in third act, so what should we do? And I just started calmly, confidently telling them what to do. I didn't know. Mm-hmm. But I sort of got a knack for it. So then I started getting paid for my notes, and then I decided this is better than working at Costco, and if I can get paid for these notes, damn, that's fantastic. And so I started doing notes for directors and writers doing film, and within it wasn't quick. It took me like 5 years. And I worked as a script reader while I was doing this, too. So I worked as a script reader for Imagine. I worked for Brian Grazer and Ron Howard. They were amazing, amazing teachers, and amazing, just geniuses at what they do. And I worked for Brian doing – Brian was an amazing guy. If he's interested in something, he'll just buy all the books on it. Mm-hmm. He wanted to do an Einstein series, and eventually he did.
Right.
But one of the things he decided he wanted to learn about was quantum physics. So he got me to read several books on quantum physics. Now, I'm an English major, right? So, mm-hmm. you know, I'm basic math at Ralph's, you know, that's it. I can't even do that. So, but I had to boil down these quantum physics books into coverage. And I learned a lot, but he would commission. And I learned a lot about movie story from him and TV story from him. He was an omnivore. He would learn everything about a subject that he was interested in. And he had Ron Bass was going to do the movie script on Einstein. And eventually this thing became what's now on, I think, National Geographic, which is a series, a television mm-hmm. series on Einstein. Mm-hmm. But it was a long process, and I just got to watch – and also participate in his creation machine, which is an amazing thing to see, because he was just – he wants to learn everything about anything that interests him. And then it eventually comes out in the story. So it was a great lesson in how you want to – how your story gets informed by every piece of information about it that you can find. And I think it's why – later on, I got interested in historical stories, and this miniseries that I just did on Jack Johnson mm-hmm. was also a historical figure. Jack Johnson was the first African-American heavyweight champion of the world. And I read everything I could get my hands on about him because, you know, Brian Grazer was sort of the guy who showed me, this is what you do. Your story will be so much more interesting if you know all this information. So anyway, so long story, even way longer, I started doing that. And then eventually, about, I guess, 12 years ago, I started ghost writing for film, for screenwriters. Mm-hmm. And I no credit, and that's often still how I work. I get paid. I get money. I don't get credit. Okay. I'm not even in the WGA, though I want to be, and that's going to be a stipulation, I think, of a couple of jobs I have coming up. I'd like to actually get in the WGA instead. And there's no real easy way to do that if you don't have your name on the scripts. But so for the last 10 or 12 years, I've done a lot of ghosting for a lot of screenwriters who want help.
So let me stop you there for a second. I've heard of, I mean, obviously ghostwriters in novels, and I've heard of, you know, script doctors, which we're going to go a little bit deeper into script doctors in a second. But I've never actually heard of a script doctor screenwriter, and a ghostwriter screenwriter. Like, are you writing full blown scripts, or are you just taking other people's scripts and then really doing the bulk of the writing, and then they get to put their name on it?
It's all of that. Sometimes, really? Yeah. Sometimes it's someone who's gotten three drafts of a big screenplay or television now, which is obviously a lot of my work now is TV. But they'll have three drafts. They've done a lot of work on it, but they want it to be better. So I'll come in, and I'm essentially in those situations, I'm giving a lot of notes, and I'm actually helping them realize their vision. I don't go, okay, well, I think this character ought to do this, 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 and this that he's not doing now. I think we need a storyline here. That's something I've learned that often screenwriters, especially fairly successful ones, don't really want you to do. They've got their own vision, and you sort of are there to deepen their vision. And mm-hmm. to really understand what they want. Now, at the same time, often what happens is I'll say, well, what if we had them do this? And then they'll say, yeah, that's great. And I love that idea for a scene. And I love this idea for a scene. And then sometimes you find yourself writing complete new storylines. But it's always in service to their vision. And if you lose that idea, you can run into trouble because they don't want you to create a whole nother story. It's not like you guys are writing partners. They want their vision, but better. But then there's also, and this happens a lot with beginning writers, and I work with beginning writers too, especially if they hire me. I mean, I will work for money. and often people that are beginning, they do want to really sort of be shown what works, and they really want my ideas. But there's all sorts of variations in that as well. Sometimes they really want their vision still on the screen, but then I'm teaching them because I am a teacher. You know, I've been a teacher at UCLA since 2003, so I do, and I'm a very good teacher. I'm probably a better teacher than writer, to tell you the truth. I still feel like my writing is it's certainly not the equal of great screenwriters. I have sold projects in the last several years under my own name. But that's a great advance for me. But I don't feel like I'm anywhere near the kind of writer that, Craig Mazin, who just did this Chernobyl. I mean, you watch Chernobyl and you just go, wow, that guy's on a different level. He's just amazing. So I'm very humble about my writing talents. It's taken me a very long time to sell, and I also know, and it's always difficult to do. You tell people this or not? This is always a dance I do when I've got someone who's interested in doing this. What do you tell them? Do you encourage them, or do you tell them the absolute truth? it's a dance because. Mm-hmm. You know, I've done this for 20 years, and I'm only now really getting some success as a writer myself. You know, John Wells said that he wished when he started out, and of course, John Wells is probably one of the greatest showrunners of all time, does all kinds of fantastic stuff. I just saw his last season of Animal Kingdom, which he just penned mm-hmm. a lot of episodes himself. She's unbelievable. He said he wished somebody told him when he started out how long it was going to take.
Yeah.
Because I get people and you don't really want when you've got total newbies and they say, well, you know, I'm going to in 6 months, I'm going to have this done. So I would go, yeah, that's fantastic. Yes. You got to aim for that. You got to go for that. But the truth is that most of the time it takes many, many years before you're any good. And obviously, if you're a super Shakespeare genius, that's not true. But I only know one guy who sat down in a coffee shop. He was a comic. He sat down in a coffee shop, and the first thing he wrote got sold. I know one guy who did that. And I don't know. And then I know a lot of writers, and none of them did that.
Okay, it's rare on both sides of the camera. Like it's it's on for actors to be a blowout success right away, or for a director to be a blowout success, or producer. Those are called lottery tickets. It happens once in a while. Like I had John August on the show the other day, and John, I asked him like, so how was it? Where was it really tough? He goes, I was lucky. My first script got sold, and. Wow. But it doesn't happen. It just generally doesn't happen. And I think you're completely right. I fall into the same world with independent filmmakers and even screenwriters where I tell them this is a long game. You cannot think this is going to – I've got a 5-year plan. I'm like, you're done. Yeah. Like that's not enough time.
Yeah, that's a 5-year plan to get me one place, but not all the way. Well, yeah, I mean, it's me. You mentioned John August. I mean, he's he and Craig Mazin have an amazing podcast. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he's super talented. I mean, I direct my students to him for just last week for some of his dialogue lessons. I mean, so yeah, a guy like that, I don't put myself in that league at all as a writer. It was a painful, long process for me to even get where I am now as a writer. And I just think I'm still a baby. I really am, especially when it comes to TV, because TV is a complex beast and it's where so much of my work is now. It's so much where most of Hollywood's work is now, although movies are coming back. But so when you're doing television and you're paneling 4, 5, 6 storylines, my head explodes. It's such a complex form. So I guess if you're a super genius like John August or this guy that I'm not going to mention because he hasn't told me I could tell him anybody about this, but this mm-hmm. comic guy who sold this and he's very successful on television, he just sat down and wrote it. But 99% of the very successful writers that I know took a long time to do it. But yeah, there's exceptions. Nancy Pimentel, who's an amazing writer on Shameless, mm-hmm. Nancy was a comic and she just, her rise, she doesn't sweat it. She just sort of writes it out. And the other thing I've noticed about people, and I don't think Nancy would mind me telling this story about her. Nancy was a comic, but she's a stand-up comic, and those guys always are mm-hmm. super talented, super genius people. They're just to do that requires so much. But she sold a movie off of a pitch. Mm-hmm. And it sold for an astonishing amount of money. This is before the big crash in 2008 and sold for like a lot of money. Cause that's mm-hmm. when movie specs were just flying off the shelves and people mm-hmm. would an enormous amount. And then these three brilliant actresses, top named actresses, you know them all. They even moved into Nancy's house because they were all going to be in the script and they hung out with her and they did. And the script had insanely great buzz. And when they were filming, it was like, this is the next thing. And, fantastic. It's going to be amazing. And all these actresses, were talking about it, interviewing about it. And then the movie came out and it was a huge bomb. And the critics were just vicious about it. Now, me, I would have crawled into my bathroom with a bunch of heroin. I wouldn't have come out for a year.
Right. But
Nancy had a party, and she invited everybody over to her house and to read these reviews and to watch the reviews, and she just laughed about them. And then she went. And then she just started writing her next thing the next day.
Because she's a stand-up comic. See, stand-up comics has a they have a different resiliency to that, because day in, I know a lot of stand-up comics. I've worked with a lot of high profile stand-up comics in my career, and they're a special kind of animal. Like, to get up on stage with a microphone and basically have to, your voice, your ability is the only thing that's going to make them laugh. And things, even the biggest, most successful comics of all time, all have bomb nights. They've all had bomb situations that they get used to it because it's day in, day out, every night. And that makes perfect sense.
That's a great, you're absolutely right. I hadn't thought about that, but you're right. They're in the fire. They're in the fire every night. And yes, they get humiliated horribly, where, yeah, actors, writers, the humiliation is secondhand or whatever. They don't really get scalded.
But it's not in their face. It's not in their face like a comic. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. I have never done stand-up. And, you know, I think everybody who hasn't done stand-up, who thinks they're funny, they have that fantasy that, yeah, they say it's really hard, but I know if I got up there, I'd kill it from the floor. You know? And I think that is the siren song of disaster, right? And yes. I still have that in my head. I got to secretly admit I do. It's like, well, you know what? I'd be different. I'd get up there. I'd be the one guy who I've never done it before. I would kill. I just know I would kill. And so, and you know what would happen if I got up there? It would be the biggest the biggest disaster in history. It would be, I'd be humiliated.
Oh, yeah.
My face would be made fun of. All my secret, horrible embarrassments, people would shout them out. You know, that's what would happen. But
you know, the funny thing is, I was directing a comedy special for a comic friend of mine, and we were doing rehearsals before the audience came in, and I stood up on stage and grabbed the mic so we can get some lighting. You know, I was doing a stand-in. And I was looking out at empty seats, and I'm like, oh hell no! Like this is terrifying. Like, and I'm an outgoing guy. I can spitball. I'm great in a room. You get me in front, you know, at a party. You get me a corner with 5 or 10 people. I'll have them on the floor crying. But this is, and I've worked with enough stand-ups to understand the technical aspects of their storytelling, how they do it, how they deliver. The timing of it is such a brutal experience. And you've got to be kind of nuts to do it as a general statement.
Oh, I think I'm fascinated by them. I think they're great, and I'm going to have to do it someday just so I get that full horrible experience that I know is coming to me. That I dare to have the secret tiny little sniggery hope, you know.
The audacity, sir.
Yeah, the audacity. I know I would be punished horribly for it. You know, I've always thought it would be fun to just have 20 guys like me, these arrogant twits who think they could do it, just get up there and give them 3 minutes and film it. I think that might be – the humiliation level might be compelling to watch, but, you know. Nobody,
do you know how much 3 minutes is? That is like an hour.
Yeah. 1 minute. You know, and I think that would be all you'd need. Yeah. Maybe all you could stand. But maybe had to stay out 3 minutes. That might be part of the horrible fun of it, is you had to stay out there even if you were being eviscerated. But yeah, I think that comics – and the thing about Nancy is that she's so funny and she's such a brilliant writer and she's done so much great stuff on Shameless. But she just didn't. I mean, I admired the balls of someone who could just get those kinds of horrible reviews and go forward. I don't even like – I can't even stand table reads. Mm-hmm. I have to take tranquilizers to have somebody – you know, I'm even when I've got the final draft, you know, voice up where they do the dog, I don't even want to hear that. So I can't stand being having my stuff bomb. I can't even stand watching it at a table read, so I've got some work to do on myself.
Now, you obviously are a script doctor, and you've done a lot of script doctoring. Can you kind of really explain to the audience specifically what a script doctor does, and try to kind of shine a light on the whole subgenre, but there's a very cultural subculture of script doctors that run throughout Hollywood that do a lot of heavy lifting that people just don't really know about. I know personally multiple big name screenwriters who have big scripts under their belt, but they have maybe three that have been produced, but they never stop working. Like they're always script doctoring or taking assignment constantly. So can you kind of touch upon that a little bit so people understand
that
underworld?
Yeah. The best way to describe it is I talked to the I can't think of his name, but he's a really good guy over at the WGA. About a year ago, I ran into him and we talked and he goes, "Oh yeah." He said, we don't really have an official category for you guys. And he was kind of laughing. And I said, "Well, you should. I mean, if you want more dues, you know, we should be able to be in the WGA as story doctors." And he goes, "The problem," he says, "is that the writers wouldn't like it." he says, "Because, you know, they don't want to acknowledge that, you know, that they didn't write the script. And even if just a story by credit, it can rankle them. And so there aren't enough of you guys to put up that new category compared to the source we'd get from the writers about it." Now, a lot of writers aren't antagonistic about it, but they can be insecure about it and not wanting to share credit. So what they tend to do
– Shocking, sir. Sorry, shocking.
Yeah, shocking. Insecurity in Hollywood. But what they tend to want to do then is pay you. And so what you get into is a bit of a Faustian bargain. Well, it's not really Faustian because it's actually pretty pleasurable. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you sell your soul. Maybe you do. Maybe it is Faustian because it does delay your development as a screenwriter yourself because you don't get credit. But they tend to pay you a good amount of money to help them, but you don't get a credit. You don't get your name on the thing.
So, or any residuals or any benefits or any of the spotlight.
Right. You don't even have, no health insurance because none of the WGA. Mm-hmm. So what I'm going to do in the next couple of years is I am going to take less money for what I do just so I can get a credit, so I can actually get on the books somewhere. So there is a sort of a surreptitious, furtive quality to script doctoring. It's a little bit shameful in a way.
It's like Hollywood's dirty little secret in a lot of ways.
Well, it's one of the cleanest dirty secrets Hollywood has.
Very true, sir. Very true.
Yeah. But yes, in a sense, we are kind of whores in that sense. We come in, we get paid, and we leave. And we leave, and no strings attached, no acknowledgement made, which I think keeps it underground. But story doctors are fine with that, again, because the money can be very good. Mm-hmm. But it is – if you want me to talk about what I actually do – it's really as varied as, let's say you have a regular doctor and he sees 10 people in a day. Well, he's going to do something different for every one of those persons because they're all sick, but they all have different things wrong with them. But then, of course, you can begin to see patterns there too. So there are things that are usually wrong with scripts, and you do look for symptoms. It's almost like you are a doctor. You can – sometimes somebody just walks in and the way they walk, you can go, okay, well, I think I know what that is. Or then you have to do x-rays or CAT scans. And I have several tools for that as well. So I often put the screenplay into a synopsis form because I like to see the bone structure of the story. And often the bone structure of the story is wrong. And if the bone structure is wrong, then everything else is wrong. And by bone structure, I mean things like storyline, structure, what the characters do. It's often not right. Now, how do I know that it's not right? What am I comparing this CAT scan to? What's the ideal script, ideal story? Well, there are wonderful, wonderful scripts, and I've read probably 5,000 to 6,000 features. I counted it up last year. I think about 6,500 features I've read and synopsized because I was a script reader for 10 years, which is way longer than you should do it. Mm-hmm. Most people do it for a year or two and then they go into the business. Well, I was too stupid to do that. I just kept reading more scripts. And then I've read several thousand television scripts too. Of those, I've sort of distilled what's good and what's bad. And believe it, that the best scripts share certain traits almost always, and no matter what the genre, no matter what the subject. And I'm not talking about French movies that don't follow Hollywood structure. Those are obviously out of my purview. Mm-hmm. You know, I love Godard, but he doesn't follow commercial structure, you know, and though that's great that he doesn't. But Hollywood does, because Hollywood has to sell. Hollywood has to sell to people all around the world. Hollywood doesn't have to ingratiate itself with film festivals or have political connections like so many European countries have, so that it isn't real whether or not you can sell tickets that gets you your movie. It's who you know on a film commission or who you can get the money from politically. You know, those are great models for filmmaking, but Hollywood is commercial, and so you have to sell tickets. So there are models that help you sell tickets. And by the way, I think selling tickets is the ultimate test of a great story. I mean, Shakespeare had to sell tickets. Mm-hmm. I think the reason Hollywood's so great, frankly, and I think Hollywood is great, the best movies are great, the best in the world, is that we have to sell tickets. We are not just trying to please a group of judges or a literary committee or a political committee. We have to sell tickets. And yes, you can say, well, that makes you a whore of China or whatever. And it does, but it also creates the very best movies. I think the very best movies in the world, a lot of them are Hollywood commercial films. So I've studied what those structures are. And they're fascinating because they're not things that amateurs understand. Mm-hmm. These structures are actually really cool. And when I was just a professor at UCLA, starting 2003, I started showing these structures in class, and I became pretty successful. I was teacher of the year there. I'm really proud of that because I had these. And that's all I really did is I showed these patterns that I'd found in film and television. Now, I thought that was really cool back then, but I was still approaching things academically. When I started applying all these patterns to my work or to the work that I was starting to get hired to do, I found that some of them were brilliant and helped me a lot to actually create story. Some of them were more film theory and academic. So that was fascinating to see as well. So anyway, as a story doctor, I've got these ideas of what makes a healthy, great body of story. And then I take an x-ray of your body, your story, and I go, oh, well, you know, your bone's out of alignment. You know, your femur doesn't hook up with your boobah, mm-hmm. you know, and that can be, you know, you don't have a core wound for your hero. You don't have proper reflector characters in your story. You don't have a good theme. You don't know where you're going in two of your storylines. They don't pay off. Thousands of things like that where I diagnose those.
Can you actually put to rest, because I think a lot of, especially first-time screenwriters and even people who've been trying to get their stuff made for a long time, they fall into this camp of like, well, structure is going to take all the creativity out of this, and mm-hmm. it's going to be very formulaic, and I'm not going to write like that. Yeah. And I've yelled at screenwriters often. I'm like, dude, it's like a frame of a house. All houses have frames, but not all houses are the same. But you still need framing. You still need structure.
Yes. I like the frame metaphor. I have one too, which is that Hollywood commercial structure is like a vanity license plate. Okay, when you see a vanity license plate, the reason it's funny is that it's a limited form. It's a limited canvas, right? Mm-hmm. But the canvas actually dictates the humor. In other words, you see a guy driving a Porsche around and his license plate, I think you get eight words.
Eight letters, yeah.
And his license plate says 3 inches, okay? So that's funny, right?
That's hilarious.
It's funny. Now, imagine that the license plate could be 10 feet long. And it says, instead of 3 inches, it says, I'm driving this Porsche because I don't have a large penis.
Right.
That's not funny, right? Right. So you actually had more room to write something, but there's no entertainment to it.
Yeah.
Commercial form is a limiting form. You must, in a movie, can't be longer than 2 hours unless you're James Cameron or Scorsese.
Or Peter Jackson.
Yeah, right. Peter Jackson. But the exceptions prove the rule. And it can't be – it's got to have three acts. It's got to please the audience at certain points. It has to do those things. The genius of it really is figuring out how to write within that very limited form something that delights people almost precisely because it's limited.
Like a haiku, almost like a haiku.
Yes, just like a haiku. Mm-hmm. So commercial form is necessarily limiting. But within those limits is where you show your genius. It's like, I made a ship in a bottle, right? Well, if you made the ship out of the bottle, big deal. You know, anybody can do that. So you've got to follow this commercial form. But I find that sort of a delightful puzzle. Now, having said that, you know, I used to be friends with Blake Snyder, who wrote Save the Cat, and Blake mm-hmm. was a genius. But Blake knew, God bless him, that his book Save the Cat was not sufficient to write a great movie, because he didn't have anything to say about character. He didn't have anything to say about huge portions of what it takes to make a great movie. He had a structure. Yeah, and you can follow a structure exactly. I have something called the BMOC structure, which all my students know about, but it's sort of like the 30-60-90, but mm-hmm. I think it's cooler. Mm-hmm. But anyway, you can do all that. You can follow structure, and like your folks say, oh my God, you can make such a boring movie. You can have a perfect BMO, you can have a perfect structure and make a terrible, terrible movie. You see it all the time. But most of the time, you don't. Most of the time, you have a lousy structure and it makes a lousy movie. But I tell people, if they're starting to write, don't worry too much about structure at all. Do a vomit draft. Write exactly out what you think you want your story to be about. Just write it all out. Write it out. Don't worry about, oh my God, I've got 30 pages for the end of the first act. I've got to have a cliffhanger here. I've got to do this. Write it all out. Write it a couple of times all out. Forget about anything. Don't write from a rule book. You'll kill yourself. And then when you're sort of run out of steam and your movie or your TV show is on the page, one of two things will happen. One, you'll be that one in a million who goes, oh, well, it's perfect. Here I go. You'll be John August, or you'll be this guy I was talking about.
Craig, right.
But 99.9% of you – and by the way, these are the people that are going to make it. These are really smart, talented people. 99.9% of them will be like, oh, well, this is really just a heap of shit. Mm-hmm. And I've got to – make it better. And that's when you start looking at it and going, okay, well, I'm going to ask you some questions. And the questions are going to lead you to maybe get excited about this guy, or get excited about this setting, or get excited about this portion of it where you did a really good job. These people are really funny in this scene. So let's explore who they were and what they are. And then you'll start going, okay, yeah, yeah. And you'll get re-excited about the story by my questions, or by the questions of anybody you collaborate with, or the reactions you get from them. And then you start going, okay, wow, well, I want this to happen here, and that's going to have consequences here. And by the way, then you're doing structure. Then you're working on structure. But here's the truth. You're going to be rewriting this thing 40, 50, 60, 70 times. And that's another sort of hard truth mm-hmm. that it can be hard to tell the beginner about. Because every beginner, me included, wanted to be John August. We all want to be the guy who just sits down, writes it out. You know, you buy a book like one of those great books you can get in the bookstore or on Amazon now, which says things like, you know, write your screenplay, you know, while you masturbate. You know, write your screenplay.
Write your screenplay in 30 days or something like that.
Yeah, or you're in 15 minutes. I saw one that said something like they implied you could write your script why you were on a break at the office, right? Mm-hmm. Getting a drink from the cooler. Mm-hmm. And it's very attractive. And some of these people have a lot of really valuable things to tell you once you get that book. But the book title is bullshit. I'm sorry. The book title is BS.
Right.
Unless you're the one in literally 20 million, you're going to have to work hard to get your script in shape, and you're going to have to write it a whole bunch of times. And that's when structure comes in. That's when storyline, when character, when premise, when all the stuff that I make a living doing comes into play. But yeah, start from inspiration. Don't start from a rule book. I think you'd kill yourself. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't work. So many of the tools I use won't work for you. You have to – I've got like 50 tools, and I'll see people come in and pick them up, and they'll go, okay, I really love this one. I think this will help, and that doesn't really help. And then there'll be another one that they pick up, and they go, oh, my God, this has helped me so much. So everybody's different, but you are going to have to eventually – structure your story, whether it's instinctive or not. You will have to structure your story because it is a commercial art form.
Now, what is the biggest mistake you see first-time screenwriters make? I mean, you have read 6,500 screenplays, so I'm assuming you've seen a couple of patterns of mistakes. Yeah.
Well, the beginning scriptwriter has a completely different problem than the professional.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest problem beginning screenwriters have doesn't have anything to do with what's on the page.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with what's in their head. And it is what we just said. I often feel like I'm more of a psychotherapist than I am a writing guide for sometimes people that start out. Because when they get that crashing realization that this is not going to happen in 2 months, that the story that they were pretty sure – and believe me, I sympathize with this enormously. I had it too when I was a young guy. The idea that in 2 months I'm going to sell this and I'm going to be in Malibu, you know, and that motivates you. And I love that it motivates you. And, you know, maybe that 1 in 20 million, you're going to win that lottery ticket and you're going to be that guy or that girl. But it's managing the disappointment of my clients or students learning that this process will take years that I find is the biggest mistake that beginning screenwriters make.
That's great.
They underestimate how long it's going to take. And then when they get a glimpse of how long it's going to take, they crumble. Oh, and by the way, that can be a really wise move. Okay. They're like, you know what? I don't want to spend the next 10 years of my life, you know, with four roommates who are all, you know, doing Chinese gong at 4 a.m. and, you know, and I'm here because I got to work my messenger job. I don't want to do that. I'm going to go be a CPA. I'm going to have a nice life. I'm going to have a house mm-hmm. In Ventura and you know.
But they'll be miserable, I promise you.
Yeah, well, maybe they will. I'm always open to wanting people to take the right path.
Yeah.
But they got to know that it's a warrior path. It's a path of Bushido. This is a path of Bushido. This is not your standard issue. This is like going to med school. This is like particle physics, you know. And people say, people in Hollywood, and it's a cliche, that there's a lot of dumb people in Hollywood who lucked into their success and they just do a few lines and they mm-hmm. have a meeting and then, you know, then they go to their house and they're done for the day. I have never run into smarter people than I have mm-hmm. in Hollywood. They're just as smart as, you know, I was in academia for a little while. They're very much as smart as university professors. They're very much as smart as Wall Street guys. They're very much as smart as all the typical stud occupations that brag about how smart they are around the world. Hollywood is full of insanely smart people that to succeed. So it's path of Bushido. Yeah, you're committing to a path where some of the most competitive people in the world are trying to do exactly what you're doing. And you've got to compete with them. And you've got to compete with their product.
Now, what I find funny, too, is that unlike the doctors, the lawyers, the CPAs, you can go down a certain path. And when you graduate, most of the time, you'll be able to find a job. You know, doctors are pretty much set up to get a job. Lawyers, you know, it may be a little harder, but generally speaking, if you're even halfway decent, you're going to get a job somewhere. CPAs, there's – God knows we need more CPAs in the world. So there's always
– We always do.
I mean, we always work. But – you can get a PhD in screenwriting, story, and mythology. It means absolutely nothing in this business.
Because it's a commercial business. Look,
right.
Hollywood doesn't give a shit. Doesn't give a crap about your credentials.
Right.
Right.
It doesn't.
Not a crap. And when people say, because I teach at UCLA and I love UCLA where I teach because the school I teach at, you've got to be working in your field right now to teach screenwriting or story development. You have to be working now. You know, you can't have done it 10 years ago. You can't just have an MFA from film school and then you decided you're going to teach. At UCLA Entertainment Division Extension School, you've got to be working in your field right now to teach how to make a movie or a television show. And for me, that is great. That's why I love UCLA, because you're actually getting it from people who have to do it. And so I think it's people often ask me, should I go to film school? And that's, of course, a loaded question. Sometimes you should, if you've got rich parents or you're wealthy and, and you want to learn a lot about film and maybe meet some people you're going to work with in the future, absolutely you can go to film school. It's going to cost you probably a couple $100,000 to do so, unless you're very lucky and get a full scholarship. And that can be extraordinary. And I know that USC is great, UCLA is great. But if you are an ordinary middle-class person, it's a tougher question to answer, because so much of what you do is going to be what you've learned just doing it. And it's – do you want to be $200,000 in debt and then coming out and then you're still in the same place – or a similar place to somebody who hasn't gone to school at all, but who's really hustling it as a assistant, you know, in Hollywood. And obviously, if you've got, you know, Hollywood parents, then all bets are off. You've got a smooth ticket in. But most of us, you know, you gotta think about that. Is school really going to give you that much of an edge? I get a lot of people at my school that have gone to film school. And they didn't learn what they thought they were going to learn. And I do think if it's a third or fourth rate film school that costs a lot of money and there are a lot of them out there, I'd be very careful about going to a school like that.
For screenwriting or for filmmaking. But I do feel truly that there is so much information that you can self-educate, you can take workshops, you can take extension classes, you can you can do what you need to do to learn the basics. And no matter all that stuff that they teach you, until you're in the fire, when you're in the fire, when the bullets are swinging by, flying by your head, that is when you learn.
And I agree.
Right?
I totally agree. And most of the people I work with, a lot of them didn't go to film school, and they're very successful. I mean, you know, the classic example everyone cites is Spielberg. You know, he didn't get into USC, although they claim him as one now. But I was confused about that. But I realized he didn't go. They turned him down.
No, he didn't. He went to a community college for a little bit, and then he dropped out of that.
And by the way, community colleges are fantastic places to learn your craft.
Yes,
I you know, I went to an Ivy League school, and I gotta say, it was no better than for actually what you're learning practically. I think community colleges are often better.
ROI, better ROI without question.
I think they are. And I think the apprentice system, by the way, is a system that worked well for 1,000 years. And I think being an apprentice, if you can get a gig in Hollywood in an actual production company, I think that is just as valuable as going to film school or more. And the other thing that I realized about film school is that I don't know if it's because it's just the nature of institutions, but they took a long time to pivot to television story. They were teaching film story exclusively up till just a few years ago, even when the industry had really pivoted to television after 2007. The bottom fell out of my business, by the way, when we had that big crash in 2007 and all the independent film companies went away because the financing wasn't there anymore. We all had to pivot to television story.
So yeah, I was gonna ask you about that. There has been an absolute explosion in long format streaming series, and there's such a need for content. Do you really believe that that is where a lot of screenwriters and writers in general can actually? There's a lot more opportunity in those areas than trying to be a feature film screenwriter in Hollywood.
Well, I'm sort of going to be a contrarian because yes, I agree with all of that. But having said all that, Apple is buying movies. Amazon's buying mm-hmm. movies again. Mm-hmm. So these guys, these IPs, these internet platforms, they're pivoting and buying movies again. But yes, of course, you're right. For the last 6 years, I think we've gone from like 200 scripted shows in Hollywood to like 2,000.
It's a lot. It's a lot of shows.
It's a lot. It's a ton of them. And but yes, so a television story has exploded. And it's kind of like the Russian novel. I mean, as the longer they get, it's a sign of the absolute the idealization of the form, right? The television's long form television has become really our Russian novel, and I'm so amazed and happy to be able to be in a business at a time when there's such a boom. Mm-hmm. In that story, and the stuff I've sold under my own name, they've both been television story. So yes, obviously the market is way bigger than it used to be.
But do you think there's, that this is a bubble? Like, do you? I mean,
you know what? Everybody says no, it's not a bubble, and that means it's a bubble. But I'll say it too, because I think television's just getting started, mm-hmm. and it is because the means of distribution, right? It's just all internet now, and so those classical distribution channels of the networks and theater, they're over. So people have an enormous thirst for story. I've got students all over the world now, because I teach international students as much as national now, because of Zoom, because I can mm-hmm. lecture anywhere. And in fact, most of the work I do is at my laptop now. Even when I'm contracted for story doctoring, you know, I sit in my house and I do the work. I don't even come in to Hollywood much anymore. So, and that sort of reflects what I think has happened to the entertainment business. It's a pipeline now that's infinite. The old pipes were like, let's say, the 3-inch pipes. They carry so much water per hour. Mm-hmm. You know, those are your networks. That's your movie theaters. Well, the pipes now can be 800 feet wide mm-hmm. because it's the internet. It's just how much data you can pack in. So people's appetite for entertainment is insane, and it's getting bigger. And we've barely scratched the surface. I've got a Nigerian client now they're starting a new television network in Nigeria. So Africa's almost untouched. I have a client coming up, a film client that's in South Africa doing a show, and they're building a studio in a city in Africa that has never had production before. Mm-hmm. I don't think obviously things are going to crash and there'll be a crash. Obviously this bubble will pop, probably because our financial markets will mm-hmm. pop, and they're the ones that fund a lot of Hollywood now. And that's what happened in 2007, I think, mm-hmm. is when the stock market crashed, all the indie money fell out of film development. And that'll probably happen again, you know, but it'll come back because we are thirsty for entertainment in our world. And so, yeah, I think it's going to get bigger and bigger. Having said that, just let me caution again, this is an insanely difficult business to get your story even in front of people who matter. It's, if anything, Hollywood's gotten more closed off in the last few years than ever. I used to tell my students, hey, you know, when you want, because I teach a class on how to become a script reader mm-hmm. On PeterRussellScriptDoctor.com. It's one of my most popular classes. And I used to tell people at the end, okay, so now here's how you get a script reader job. You know, you go on IMDb Pro, you get it's $20 for a month, and then you go look up all the production companies and you see what they've got greenlit. So that means they've got money. If they're making movies, they can't lie about it. They're making movies, that means they've got money, and they're the people who are going to hire you. Mm-hmm. So just go on there, find those companies, and then you look and you say, okay, they got a director of development, here's the email. Well, guess what? A couple of years ago, they stopped putting their emails up on IMDb mm-hmm. Pro. And yep. and now there's not even phone numbers there. I was trying to pitch an exec I used to work for, and I couldn't even find out what building he was in anymore. I couldn't find his email, his old email, and I still haven't gotten a hold of Arturo because I don't know what building he's in. I know the company he works for. I know where the building is physically. I literally can't contact Arturo because I don't have any way to do it. So they've sort of shut down, and I don't know why this is, but they've sort of even more recently shut down all ways to get in touch with them. So mm-hmm. you've got a lot of frustrated creators out there that I have to tell every day, look, I'm sorry, it's really tough.
Would you recommend that, you know, like I always tell people that if you're a screenwriter, you should try to start, you know, developing your own projects and producing your own work, because that's a great way to get seen, because you're stepping yourself out of the crowd, because not everybody does that.
And yes. With it,
yeah, yes and yes, right?
Yeah. Look, I was at a big film mart recently, and I noticed the way people sold their work, if they're new, they have a 3-minute trailer on their iPad, and they mm-hmm. go up to the sales agent or the manager or the agent, and they shove it under their nose and go, look, here's what we did. They don't even give them a log line. They don't even pitch them a script. They thrust this image under their nose. Mm-hmm. And so for 2 minutes, this guy will watch their sample reel. Mm-hmm. And it isn't a sizzle deck. It's an actual excerpt of their show. Let's say it's 4 women. They want to make the new friends. They've shot it in their apartment in New York City. They're in Bed-Stuy, and they spent maybe $5,000 total on an 8-minute webisode, which mm-hmm. is a great way to pitch now to Netflix and stuff. And then they take it to the sales agent, and they just thrust it under their nose of the manager. They go, here's what we did. We've already got it down in the can. That's how people were selling at this mart. That's who Netflix was interested in. And they weren't interested in many of those, but they were in some of them. But if that's the way people are doing it now, not, oh, I'm going to take my log line and my script sample and I'm going to do a pitch, a verbal pitch for, you know, 4 minutes in front of a manager and agent. They want to see that trailer. They want to see it. And that's if you can get a hold of them. I mean, just getting in front of a Netflix person. We did that a few months ago for this Jack Johnson miniseries that we sold. And the guy listened to the pitch and he said, "Well, where's your trailer?" He said, "We don't have a trailer. I've got this little picture of Jack Johnson. You want to see it?" And then he said, "Okay, so how much are you going to ask? How much are you going to ask for if I was going to buy this? What would you tell me the price was?" And we were so dumb, we hadn't even thought of that. Jesus. And so finally, my partner is a sweet, wonderful guy. Just said, "Well, what do you think?" And the guy gave us the figure. Mm-hmm. And he said, here's what you asked for. Never asked for less than this. So it was fascinating to see, you know, the selling end of this, how difficult it is just to get in front of one of the people that can get your project done. It's very tough.
I'll tell you what. I was reached out by Amazon Studios. Reached out to me about a project like out of the blue, which is insane, right? So I get a call out of the blue, and they're like, "It's Amazon Studios. We'd like to set up an appointment." All this stuff, and I'm like, "Great, this is insane, right?"
Wow.
And the project never happened, but I did have multiple calls with them, and then I spoke to some high-level executives at Amazon, but every time they called me, the phone number was different. I'm not kidding you. Every time I got called, their phone numbers were different. And then to the point was when this whole – you know, we went through this whole project and it didn't go through, I can't get anybody back on the phone.
Yeah, exactly.
I can't.
Yeah, it's always the way it is, eh? They're very super paranoid. I'm sure they have to be.
Yeah, because everybody's trying to pitch them. And even if they approach you, they still like, you're still not part of the team yet.
Yeah. You know, hey, watch out. Be careful. Don't get too close to me. I'm standing here, but I could go away at any moment.
It's hilarious. But, you know, but what I find that a lot of people are still teaching the old ways of doing things, which is that log line, the elevator pitch, and that's fine. And there's still pitch fests and all of that kind of good stuff. But what sets people apart is what you just said. If you have a trailer, if you have a reel, a sizzle reel, something that a producer or a production company or somebody can see, and you have a good story and you have a good script, that's almost, I feel that that is the new norm, and that's where we're all going. Like, if you don't have a sizzle reel, if you don't have 4 minutes of a scene, if you don't have a trailer, you won't even walk in the door, even if you can find the door.
Yeah, and I've got a class in how to make a webisode, and I always urge people to take this class, because the webisode form is an ideal way to show off your skills to a TV producer. It's a very short form. You've got to do a lot of things in it. You've got to do what I call a BMOC, a sequence set. There's all these things you need to do in your webisode. And you really should study it because, as you said, this is how you get the job now. You don't do it with a pitch off a 3x5 card. And maybe next year that'll change again. Mm-hmm. But this is the current market, and yes, you, and by the way, you only learn that by going to these marts and seeing how it actually works. I don't think too many people are teaching that, because just the nature of the beast is that they're behind the times. The other thing is you can do is obviously you can put your shit up on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And I have to say the one of the main reasons I have that I get my jobs is word of mouth, but also I've got a lot of interviews now up, and I get people contacting me. I got my current manager because she saw me on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And of course, she hates me. I hate her. She tells me I'm horrible. I tell her she's horrible. We have a mm-hmm. classic dysfunctional manager relationship. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's just, that's just kind of what it is. I mean, this business is so full of, and I don't mean she really hates me, and I don't really hate her, but there's an antagonistic relationship you have with the people that are supposed to help you sell, because their job is so difficult, because you don't know so many things they know about the business and you don't want to know. So it's always an interesting day. There's never a dull day. I've never had a dull day in Hollywood, but it's always exciting. It's full of shouting and anger but also greatness. So mm-hmm. I don't have great advice on how to get a manager, an agent. It's like a real estate agent. You almost have to have a beautiful big house, and then yes. they'll come knocking, right?
It's exactly it. That's exactly because if you don't, it's like it. That's a great analogy. Imagine if you're going to go get a real estate agent. Like, I need a real estate agent. When you finally get one, they're like, "Well, what do you have?" I'm like, "I have this idea for a house."
Yeah, exactly. And people always say, to me when I do seminars and stuff, they go, "Well, just assume I've got a great script. How do I get an agent or manager?" And I said, that's like saying, okay, look, let's assume I'm a great brain surgeon. So am I going to do your surgery on you? How am I going to do you? That assumption is insane. I mean, if you have a great project, why not have a great project before you think about an agent or manager? Because I think some people think that Hollywood's a place where once you get in the door, everybody's the same. And okay, I love your project. I don't even need to see it. Here's your money. But the first thing they'll tell you is, I'm a big agent. You're meeting me. What do you have to sell me? And people don't want to think about that sometimes. They just want to think, once I get that agent, I'll be able to write something great. Well, you got to write something great. You really do. And it can take you years before you even ought to think about an agent or manager. I know people don't want to hear that. They want to shortcut it. And there's some people in Hollywood, by the way, who will help you with that delusion. They'll say, we're going to get you in a room with a bunch of famous agents and managers. That's what we offer here. We offer access to you. And people will pay money to get into that room. But then they don't have anything to sell. They're not going to just like the person, the agent's not going to go, I like the cut of your jib, boy.
Well, that's the myth that Hollywood has been selling since, what's her name was found at that ice cream bar back in the 30s
or 40s. Well, that's an actor, by the way. And yes, actors do advertise themselves on their bodies. I mean, if you're gorgeous, then that's sometimes all you need to be for an agent or fascinating looking.
Because that's a product. That's a product that they can sell.
It's the product right there, and they'll take you. Writers don't have that. Most writers aren't gorgeous. A few of them are. Actually, my friend Nancy's gorgeous.
How dare you, sir? How dare you?
Oh, believe me, I'm not gorgeous either. But even if we were, then we might want to be actors, and that's fine. But our product is internal, or it's on a page. So we have to have that product. Our equivalent of a beautiful face is our story. Mm-hmm. And you gotta realize you're not going to get an agent or a manager on the force of your personality or your charm, or even your hustle. I had a manager tell me the other day. She said, "Look," she said, "I don't ever accept any manuscripts from anybody unless they're a friend of a client." And she said, and "The reason is, if you're talented, you have talented friends." And so that's my filter is if I've already employed you, if you're already an actor or a writer who's working for me, then if you've got a friend, they'll be talented too. So that is, I guess, the good news for someone who's a networker. Maybe don't try to meet managers of agents, but maybe try to meet talented people and befriend them. That can be a way to use networking to your advantage in Hollywood if you're a writer. Have talented friends.
Now, would you suggest, and I know this is a very out there concept, but how about instead of spending the time chasing a manager or agent, how about spending that time on the craft and becoming a better craftsman?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the obvious answer, and that's the one we give. I always give that, and that's correct.
Yeah. But
people are thirsty for so many jobs are about who you know. They really are. Mm-hmm. And Hollywood can be, of course, too. If you're a rich kid and your dad's the head of a studio, then your path is smooth. It won't be easy, but it'll be smooth. But for people who really want to say, well, I'm a hustler. I want to be able to hustle. How do I hustle in Hollywood? I would say, yeah, don't try to hustle a manager agent. Hustle up some friends, some talented friends who you think are going places. If they get representation, then you can say, hey, Dale, you know, here's my script. Give it to her. And this manager told me that the other day. She said, I do believe if you're talented, you've got talented friends. So I'll read a script if one of my existing clients has a friend that has a good script and they say it's good. I'll read the script. But, yeah, otherwise it's very difficult to come into this town as a writer and network your way into gig.
It doesn't work, because at the end of the day, you have to have the goods. You have to have the goods, whether it's a product that you've already created or multiple products you've already created, to prove that you have the goods. But they're not going to take you on the word. Just because you're a nice guy, they're not going to go, you know, I'm going to give you that first shot on the next Marvel movie because you were able to get to me and I like you. It doesn't work that way.
Doesn't work. And by the way, there is a slot for those people, but it's your brother, or it's your cousin, or it's your son or daughter. I mean, nepotism in Hollywood is huge. So you're not going to get in there anyway, even if they do like you. That slot's already full. It's the nepotism slot, you know. That's not going to work either. But hey, having said all that, you know, the business is bigger than it used to be. Mm-hmm. It's actually a really good time to be entering as a writer. You just have to realize that it's also still insanely hard. It's the door is slightly ajar. Actually, the door is not ajar anymore. It's just inside the room. The house is bigger. But the door is still really hard to open.
But more people are trying to go through that door too.
You're right. I think you're right. You know, when I'm at UCLA in the coffee shop and I'm sitting there and the entire university is all there, right? It isn't just film people. Everybody's talking about their television show or their screenplay. They're all, you know, even if they're pre-med or pre-law, everyone's got a show. I think entertainment has become just overwhelming. It's exciting. I mean, I love it. I love what the business we're in. I think it's an amazing, fun, wonderful business. And so a lot of people want to do it for sure. But 90% of those people won't really be your competitors, because they'll either stop when it gets really hard, or they're too sane to take the notion that they're going to do something for 5 or 6 or 10 years that may completely not pay off.
Right.
You know, sane people who think about their IRAs and retirement and, you know, and kids, you know, sane people don't really enter this business. We're all insane.
Without question. You have to have a little – we're carnies. As I always say, we're carnies.
That's what I say too. Yeah, we're carnival. You know, we're those guys you saw, you know, smoking next to the Tilt-A-Whirl, you know, when you were in high school, right? The guy with Popeye tattoo on their arm who looks like they take your wallet. That's us.
That's basically what we are. And you've got to be a little insane to be in this business. There's no – I mean, I've been in it 25 years and I've seen a lot and – the one thing that's common is that everyone's nuts. And there's very smart nuts, but you've got to have a little bit of insanity to do this. Because like you just said, if you just sell the pitch of you're going to work for 10 years on something that you have absolutely no guarantee that you'll ever be successful at, and it has nothing to do particularly with you possibly, you might be a genius, but the breaks might not happen.
Yeah, but chances are the genius part's important. But look, I deal with this as a professor all the time. Mm-hmm. I have to tell, and I don't tell people this, but I should tell people this. I wrestle with it all the time. And in any fine art, this is probably the case. But 1 to 2% of you are going to succeed. 1 to 2% of a class. Maybe not even that. Now, how do you palatably tell people that? It's very difficult, but the fine arts have always been that way. They're very demanding. There's not many jobs. So you have to go into it with the idea that it's going to make you a better person, and also you couldn't not do it. You know, and this is cliched advice that everybody gives, but it's true. If you cannot do it, don't do it. If you can mm-hmm. avoid a career in show business, avoid it. Because you'll probably be more content, at least in the short run. But if you can't avoid it, those are the people that should do it. Because you're never going to be happy being a CPA if you've got that burning desire. You're just not. You'd rather wonder. Hey, I might end up being an Uber driver. I mean, I don't know. you know, I've sold some stuff, but only in the last couple of years. I did this for 20 years without really having my name on anything that's sold. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I made enough money to live on, thank God. And most people don't even do that. But because you do need a side hustle usually. And that's why script reading, by the way, can be a good thing, because you can do it at home in your jammies you've got to live a really small life. And by the way, while all your friends are having their kids and they're driving their Mercedes and they got their big homes and they're going to France in the summer and they're doing this and doing that, you're going to be in your rent control apartment in West Hollywood eating peanut butter. You know, I just always like to lay out the most dire career. So
peanut butter. What are we the Rockefellers? Peanut butter.
Yes, exactly.
It's ramen, sir. It is ramen.
Okay. Top ramen, whatever. that's what it is. But you know, Jerry Seinfeld said, you know, he was interviewing the South African comic.
I forgot his name.
Yeah, and the guy said, he said, when do you get up? And he said, I get up around 11 p.m. and then I go to clubs. I go to 5 clubs, and then I get home at 8 in the morning. And Seinfeld said to him, you're a classic. You're going to be just fine. This is going to be your life, and you're going to do really well. And of course he has, but. That's the sort of pure dedication that this sort of thing requires.
Did you ever see the documentary Jiro Dreams of Sushi?
No, but I heard of it.
It's a fantastic documentary about this master sushi chef whose restaurant's in a subway. He's the only sushi chef ever to get a Michelin star. That's how good he is.
Wow.
And
is
when
he – subway in Japan?
He's like in a subway somewhere in Japan, and it like takes 3 months to get it a reservation. And basically you walk in, you say nothing, and whatever Jiro gives you, you eat. And that's basically it. But your life will change once you do it. But the reason I'm saying is, if you want to be an apprentice with him, It's a 7-year apprenticeship, and you have to agree to 7 years. I think it's 7 or 10 years. I'm not sure. I don't remember exactly. Yeah. But what I found really fascinating is because, you know, this is exactly what happens with screenwriters and filmmakers, is they want to jump in. They're like, oh, I want to jump on that techno crane and let's start moving the camera. I want to be like Scorsese and everything. I'm like, calm down. Calm down, Sorkin. Just calm down for a second. Their apprentice, in order to touch fish, because if you're a sushi apprentice, you're assuming that you're going to touch a fish, right?
Yeah.
You don't touch fish for 3 years.
you're watching all you, the
floor. No. You're cooking rice.
Oh, my God.
You have to cook the rice. You have to master rice first before you're ever allowed to touch a fish. And that is what we here in our business need more of and need more understanding of, that you're going to have to write and write a lot. And you're going to read a lot.
That's true. And you know, what I see a lot, and I did this myself, is I would think about writing more than I wrote. And I think there's 6 months or a year, I'd go by, you know, that's a fantastic idea. I just have to write it down. And there's a lot of that in the biz, which is that, you know, you don't actually get to the page. You don't do that much writing. And that's a really bad thing. Mm-hmm. It's like, and I think a lot of people, when they feel like, oh, why haven't I gotten anywhere? You say, well, how much have you actually written? Do you write every day? No, I write once a week. I write when the spirit moves me. then, you know, they're not cooking that rice, right? They're just not cooking the rice. Yeah. And so, and I think I also had a person that had a lot of money. They had a trust fund, and they'd wanted to be a screenwriter for like 20 years. But they'd actually only written one script in that entire 20 years. So there wasn't that urgency. Yes, you got to write, you got to do your thing. And that's why I think it's great to apprentice with someone and really just start doing scenes and start and pick up the camera and make something, you know, make a TikTok, you know, even these commercial forms that are now prevalent in social media, where you have 30 seconds to make your movie or 45 seconds to make your movie, or TikTok. I don't think that's 15 or 20. Mm-hmm. Those impose discipline on you, and they make you need to tell a story in that form. And it's all about that discipline. So yeah, cook the rice, man. That's a good metaphor.
Now I'm going to ask you a few questions. I ask all my guests, what are 3 screenplays every screenwriter should read?
Oh, wow. Okay. Are we talking film or are we talking television?
Give me a couple of film and one television one.
Okay. Well, I think one of the greatest, I have to go 2 with TV.
That's fine.
One is, The Wire. I think you should read The Wire's entire first season, which I guess is cheating because you asked one script, and also read The Wire Story Bible, because Simon is, and I don't know if you've seen his newest one in The Deuce. Simon is one of the most brilliant journalistic writers there are. He creates worlds, and his dialogue is extraordinary. It's so naturalistic. It almost feels like a documentary. Mm-hmm. And that's true of all of his work. But if you want the most sort of brilliant naturalistic storytelling you can find around, I think he and then Chase. So in television, I really think there are 3 great guys you want to study. Mm-hmm. Yes, one of them is Simon. The other one's David Chase and The Sopranos, because again, the writing is extraordinary. And then I think Matthew Weiner also is a brilliant teller of television story. I think that – I'm sorry. I'm going to go – Vince Gilligan.
Oh, of course.
If you want to study the hour form, the television form, Vince Gilligan is just the greatest at what he does. I still teach the pilot of
Breaking Bad.
Breaking Bad, because structurally it just shows you what an amazing writer was. Now, I will also tell you that I think for network television, I think you can study John Wells. I think the way that Wells writes is amazing, and it's a sort of a different kind of storytelling on network. So those are the guys that I would really recommend. They're the sort of the classics.
Okay.
And then I think, by the way, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, also television writer, Fleabag. Mm-hmm. Phoebe Waller-Bridge is an extraordinary writer. She's probably the best new television writer we've got. She comes out of playwriting, as a lot of these guys do. And then for screenplays, gosh, there's you almost have to
three to come to mind.
Okay, well, this is one that I don't know how much he's going to help you. It's Charlie Kaufman. I love Charlie.
Oh, love Charlie.
But he's such a singular genius. He doesn't follow structure really, although he really kind of does. But it's difficult. But I love him. I can read his stuff. All the time. Mm-hmm. And so I also, well, I think that, oh God, there's so many. I think that probably, that's probably true. Okay. So I think that Robert Towne, I do think that the mystery thriller, is such a potent, vision. So I would say Town as classic, and then I think the Coens. I think Joel and Ethan Coen are probably the greatest filmmakers that we have right now.
And
of course, they write television too. And if you like action, I think Christopher McQuarrie. Mm-hmm. I often use his stuff for modeling action. Alan Ball, anything mm-hmm. by Alan. I almost go more by writers than by
screenplays. Work. Sure.
Because it's what helps me. And Alan Ball's been an enormous help for me in a drama that I'm writing right now. Steven Zaillian is amazing, mm-hmm. Sort of a classic. I've been reading William Goldman scripts, who was a 60s screenwriter, and his world building and his cinematic style is just amazing. I love Brian Helgeland.
There was three. There's three.
Sorry. Sorry. I went nuts. By the way, there's like 40 more that are just about as good. So, I think that, yeah, that'll do. Okay. Sorry.
Okay. Good. Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
How hard I have to work.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of lazy, and I think it's probably the reason it took me so long to succeed. I'm kind of lazy, and I have delusions of grandeur, so I kind of want to be a big deal. But when I see the work involved, I'm like, oh God, damn! Let's have a joint. So I think learning how to work super hard was the toughest lesson for me in life, and also as a writer. You know, the first thing I ever wrote won a big prize, and I thought that was really cool. I was 20 years old. And I thought that I was home free, man. My life was going to be fantastic. And it was the worst thing that could have ever happened to me, because I didn't have a good work ethic and I thought I was a genius. And I see a lot of people with that who want to go into Hollywood. They think they're a genius and that's going to be more important than their work ethic. And the appalling truth is it's not. And a work ethic is everything that your Boy Scout master and all those nasty adults that were so boring, all the things they told you about, that life was about, that you sneered at if you were a little rebel like me. Turns out they were right, that hard work is an enormous, important part of success. And yeah.
Now, what did you learn from your biggest failure?
Okay. Well, I wrote a book that I wrote 3/4 of a book when I wanted to be a novelist, because that was my first big love. Mm-hmm. And it was picked up by probably the most prestigious publisher in New York, even the one it was even just halfway done. I got a big agent. I just sent her the first chapter and she's, oh my God, you're the next whatever. And then she sent it to this press and they said, oh my God, you're amazing. We had a meeting about you. We want you to come to New York, blah, blah. All this wet dream crap that you never imagined was going to happen to you happened to me. And then I couldn't finish the book. even though the publisher flew me out to New York and said, hey, we're going to sit down with you and walk you through the outline, something my agent said had never happened in her whole career. This guy, that's how much he loved my vision and said, I could never finish the book.
But why?
Well, and this goes to structure and what we talked about earlier, what you were saying about structure and what people think about structure. I think what happened is I had written the first half of the book purely on instinct and adrenaline and pleasure. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a clue in my head what was going to happen next. And then I got halfway done and I should have just finished. But I got halfway done and I thought, oh, well, you know, I got to get an agent. We got enough here. I read in the book, if you got a couple of chapters, you send it out. So I sent it out. I sent half the book out and got the agent, got the publisher, got it all. And then they said, this is fantastic. We can't wait. I got an advance. Then I went back. I was living in Topanga and I went back to my little cabin. And for the next 6 months, everything I wrote was shit crap, because I had this structure now in my head. Now you've got to do this, this, and this. Now your hero has to do this, this, and this. And I couldn't get my hero to do any of that stuff. All the entertaining, effervescent tone, because it was a comic novel, was gone. And nothing he did, it was all leaden. It was awful. And 3 times the publisher came in with a new plan. Oh, well, that's terrible, Peter, but you're gonna do it. Here's another plan. Mm-hmm. Here's another plan. So structure can sometimes kill you. And that's why I imagine I say, when you're writing your script and you're cooking, don't quit. Just get it all out on the page. Ride your excitement as long as you can. Maybe you'll be done. And even if you're not done, you'll have this whole work on the page mm-hmm. that's of a piece that isn't about, oh, got to plug in column A, got to do B, got to do C, because that can kill your creativity. That's what I learned from my biggest failure. Okay. Don't always try to rely on books and structure and stuff you read. Just ride your own excitement as long as you can, and then you'll have to go to structure and stuff. And by the way, Hollywood story is such a complicated form that the chances are you're not going to get the whole thing out, and you are going to have – and this is the last thing I'd say. Mm-hmm. If you can have a collaborator, have a collaborator. This is such a lonely business, and it's so hard. Mm-hmm. If you can have somebody who helps you, who you're co-writing with – I've seen it many times because that's kind of what I get hired to do sometimes. I'm your professional friend. I'm your screenwriter, but I'm also your friend in this business. You know, I'll help you at this screen. If you can have a collaborator, so many people do. And the reason is this is so hard. And doing it by yourself can feel terribly lonely. So having a part, it's not till I got partners, by the way, that I really sort of started having some success under my own name.
Now, where can people find more about you and the work you do?
Okay. Well, it's just this simple. It's my first and last name, Peter Russell, scriptdoctor.com. That's it. Peter Russell, scriptdoctor.com. That is where, if you go to Peter Russell, scriptdoctor.com, that's where all my classes are, my lectures. I've studied most genres, and I have lectures in every genre on my site. And they talk about all the things I've observed that the greatest writers in this genre, whatever the genre is, love stories, rom-coms, action, mm-hmm. whatever the common patterns are that these guys and girls use, I show you those patterns. And I've noticed that when I give a writer these patterns, when they get stuck in their story, if they're writing a rom-com, or they go and they look and they see, oh, that's what this guy did at this point. Oh, my God. And this is how this guy created this character. And this is how these lovers fell in love. And this is how they this is when they fell out of love. And this is why. And this is what almost every great romantic comedy character has in them every time. So and some of those things will, in my experience, they will set your heart aglow and they'll fire you up again and you will be excited about your project because, you know, like Picasso said, you know, talented people borrow, geniuses steal. Mm-hmm. And I do think that – and these aren't structural patterns, although those are in some of them. These are tricks. These are – tricks that the greatest people like Tarantino use in his story. They're tricks. They're tricks with guns. They're tricks with knives. They're tricks with the suspense. They're tricks with the way you enter a scene and get out. He stole so much of what he did from 1970s drive-in film directors, mm-hmm. who had a whole bag of tricks that he uses in all of his work. He stole from classics too, but you want to steal stuff and you can't patent suspense devices. You can't patent what Hitchcock did. You can't patent what Nolan does. You can't patent what Tarantino does. They're there for you to steal. Mm-hmm. And I just show you the big glass case of things I've stolen. Hey, would you like to try this? Mm-hmm. You know, here's a plot device, man. I think you'd love it. And you go, okay, I'll try that. Let me have one of those and two of those. It's like when John Wick goes in to get his guns, you know? So that's kind of what I've got there on that site. It's a glass cabinet full of tricks you can steal.
Peter, we can keep talking for at least another 2 or 3 hours, I know, for sure. Okay. For sure. But I do appreciate you taking the time and dropping knowledge bombs on the tribe today. And it's been very educational without question. So thank you so much for being on the show, my friend.
Dude, I love your show, and I think you're performing a real service. And it's been really entertaining and fun. So – yeah, I've been really appreciative. Thanks for your intelligent questions.
I want to thank Peter for coming on the show. I really appreciate all the insights that you brought to the tribe today. So thank you, Peter. If you want to get links to Peter's work, his little tricks of the trade that he offers on his website for you guys to take a look at and steal, as he puts it, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/BPS058. And guys, if you haven't already checked out, I have done a complete revamp of Indie Film Hustle TV, and I added a ton of new trainings, series, docs about the screenwriting process. It has become a treasure trove for not only screenwriters, but for filmmakers as well. And if you want to check that out, please head over to ifhtv.com, available on Apple TV, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, as well as iPhone, iOS, and Android apps. Thank you for listening. I really appreciate all the support. I hope this episode was of value to you on your journey. As always, keep on writing, no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.